21st century has ushered in events and issues that cause us to ask, where is God in today's world? In response, Dallas Theological Seminary presents DTS Dialogue, Issues of God and Culture, The Chronicles of Narnia. The first major motion picture of C.S. Lewis' epic series has swept the nation and has drawn attention to the significance of biblical themes in contemporary cinema. Join us as we examine some theological and cultural implications of The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Part 2.
You know, one of the things that I think it's interesting, the comments that I've read thus far, people have been amazed that it is, depending upon how you interpret this particular statement, it's the best of Hollywood. Mm. I mean, it's the best that is available today. You mentioned, the special effects of Lord of the Rings, and it was thrown at this movie.
It's the best of Hollywood limited by the PG rating. Although that scene is very violent, it's not bloody. Mm-hmm. There's some suspense involved, but the story is so clear and is so foreshadowed that there's no doubt that the main characters survive and win. Aslan wins. Everybody knows that from the very beginning.
So
the suspense is more of the suddenness of an animal jumping out of off camera onto the scene, but there's no blood. I mean, people are gored and dropped to the ground, and there's no puddle of blood there.
So in other words, you're saying you think that there were specific attempts to keep it?
Oh, I think without question.
Yeah, okay.
Had the battle scene been displayed with blood and guts, it wouldn't have had a PG.
And that's great for parents that might be listening to this, to consider as they're thinking about their kids. That's a question in and of itself.
Yet it's a caution.
You all have children. I have children. What are your thoughts in that regard?
Yeah, I would not take young children to this film. I think preschool age children. I just would be concerned about the level of violence.
I think that depends a lot on the children. I think that's a decision that parents need to make for themselves. The second time I saw the film, I've seen it twice now, I saw it in the company of about six other adults and about 15 children ranging from teenage down to 3 years old. And in the final battle scene, where the dwarf is getting ready to stab, is it Edmund or Peter? I've forgotten at the moment. And Lucy grabs her bow and arrow and skewers the dwarf with an arrow. And the three-year-old immediately jumped up and says, "That's what you get." So she was very clear on who was good and who was evil.
Sure.
And that evil gets paid back here with what they deserve. So, I think it's something that, parents, if they really have young children, they might want to see the movie for themselves and decide before they take their kids.
But which is always good advice.
You bet.
Anyone school age or older should be fine with it. And I agree with Glenn. There was virtually no blood anywhere in any of the battle scenes that I can recall.
Wasn't one of the points of the story, the creation of the story originally, to, in the midst of the Blitz, to on the one hand be a deflection from what was going on, but on the other hand to raise the issues that life and death and war raise, and to put it in a context in which you could have other kinds of discussions outside of the story with children?
Well, now this is an interesting thing because I'm going to refer to an essay, or it was a talk, but it was later published as an essay, that J.R.R. Tolkien did in the early 1930s. It's called On Fairy Stories. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Tolkien argued in this essay, which I think had a big influence on Lewis, because this is almost certainly before Lewis starts to write the first of the Narnia books, which is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Tolkien argues, among other things, for the role of human beings as sub-creators under God who can imaginatively create this fictional universe and populate it and exercise a creative function that's actually part of the image of God in humanity, the imago Dei, and that one really most fully is acting in God's image when one does this creative exercise, which is a very interesting theology of a Christian theology of the arts and creativity things like that. But what Tolkien argued was that when you create this alternative world,
The diegetic world.
Yes.
That's right. The world off steroids.
And in which you enter through what's sometimes called a willing suspension of disbelief. That is, we go into this world and we just take it at face value that it's real and it operates according to its own rules. And we walk into it and it seems to us it's a real world. But Tolkien argued that you can portray good is truly good and evil is truly evil in very polarized terms. Very different from the grays that we encounter in this real world where people operate from mixed motives and there's all kinds of pressure from all sides that are influencing. And in this alternative world, you can portray really good is good and evil is evil, and you're forced to choose up sides. And in choosing up sides in this imaginative world, you learn something about the process of making the choice between good and evil, so that when you come back to your own world, the real world, the world that we live in, you're somehow better equipped to exercise discernment between good and evil and to make those choices when here they appear in shades of gray.
You know, what's interesting about that is that if you look at the way film and television have operated, media have operated across the decades, if you go back to kind of what some people view as the golden age of media, you know, where good and evil were in clear contrast.
Absolutely.
Right. Even your clothes reflected, you know, you wore white
or
white
hats.
Black, you know.
That's right.
That you had this strong contrast. And to a certain degree in a lot of movies today, we've lost that. In fact, sometimes the tendency is to try and help us portray the bad guy as almost having good traits, perhaps
right.
Bonnie and Clyde being an example of that.
Right.
And
speaking of blood
films,
and guts.
That's exactly right. Exactly. That's right. That's a diegetic world. So, but the point here is that, you know, even the way media has responded to helping us with those kinds of questions has changed in the decades. That at least I've been a part. And I was thinking about, now this will date me, I was thinking about the series Maverick, you know, back when I was growing up, where, you know, it would get in a tense spot and you would, and in the back of my mind, I never felt any tension because I knew there was next week and he had to be on next week.
Mm-hmm.
And so just a variety of things in the way literature and a creative world helps us to think through how we respond, and as we make that more gray, we actually, in many cases, are reflecting. In fact, the claim is to be more realistic and to be less idealistic about the way we portray good and evil.
Glenn, did you see it that way?
No, I really took it differently, and that I found the White Witch character a very effective portrayal of evil, and it is that encounter with Edmund where I think we see the enticement of temptation in that this character, when she shows up, is very cold and distant and actually a bit intimidating. She's really tall, but through offering Edmund this Turkish delight, which he loves, and she's able to entice him to be on her side and to work at betraying his family members. I found that a really intriguing characterization of her, because from then on out she is in a fairy tale world, in the fantasy world, she is a very evil character. But that Edmund would be so easily enticed by her, I think, provides a nice glimpse into, if we move into the biblical world, a really nice entree into the original temptation narrative, that you figure, how could any one with half a brain fall for the temptation of the evil one? But we do it all the time. That may be one of the great benefits of that scene, is that we are to see Edmund is us and how easily enticed we are.
Well, I think there's something else to note as well, and that is that Edmund has already had problems, both in the book and in the movie. He's already, so quote-unquote, going bad, if you will, because he actually gets into Narnia when Lucy goes a second time, and realizes that her story, which the others had not believed initially, was really true. And then when they return back to this world after the second trip, and Lucy's explaining how she was there again and Edmund was with her and all, he turns around and denies that any of this was real and says he was only pretending to go along with Lucy in her imagination. So he really betrayed her and let her down. And in a sense, Edmund has set himself up for this encounter with the White Witch, and when she comes along and offers her candy and her warm drinks and promises to make him a prince and maybe someday even king in Narnia, since she has no children of her own, he's sort of ready to fall, if you will. He's been set up already by the path he's been on. I think the other interesting thing, though, about the portrayal of the White Witch with regard to her evil is, I think there's the point to be made that by the time Edmund starts to see that maybe she's not so nice after all, he's in too far.
It's too late.
And that, I think, is an excellent portrayal of the enticement of evil. Mm-hmm. By the time you really see what evil is for itself or who Satan is, it's too late.
I will say that I thought that the portrayal of the relationship between the siblings was very well done. So that by the time you got to that scene with the White Witch, that you knew there was something going on. You were well set up for that scene. And so from that standpoint, I thought that you knew who kind of the bad apple was in the group.
Right.
And it made for an interesting situation for, you know, I'm someone who saw the movie not having read the book. And so from that standpoint, I mean, my children have read it dozens of times. My daughter, the first thing she got on the phone, I said, "Well, how was the movie?" She said, "Well, there were two things in the movie that weren't in the book." That was the first thing she noticed, which is typical of someone who's an aficionado. But for me, it was just refreshing to walk through the story, and I felt well set up to understand the children's relationships to one another by the time Narnia came on the scene.
Which is another place where there is no subtlety. I
mean, exactly.
Those characters are so stereotypical. Mm-hmm. You have the older brother's responsibility is to care for his family. You have the older sister who's really not active at all. You have the younger brother, and you always have that in those kind of stories. And then the little younger sister who's perfect.
Right.
I mean, it's very, very stereotypical. But I think there's a profound question in there that these kind of stories raise, is that although good and evil are clearly portrayed and really are polarized, there's the profound question underlying that is that the only reason why Narnia is in the state that it is because Aslan is absent. Mm-hmm. And so the question that's never addressed is why he is gone for 100 years of winters with no Christmas. That, by the way, I thought Santa Claus could have been portrayed a little more clearly Santa-Claus-like.
Well, it's because he was Father Christmas, not Santa Claus. This is England, remember?
No, the film is in America.
Not in England. Still have British accents.
Why is the world in the situation that it is because Aslan is absent. And when Aslan comes back, it will be right. So we have this tension, which never really asks nor answers the question of why the absence of the lion for so long.
It begs for the question of Aslan's death and resurrection. Let's end with that. I mean, the climax of the book, climax of the movie. I need somebody to define atonement because we have to relate that storyline, how it's portrayed, to a definition of that. And to talk about how does that work its way out at the end of the book. Glenn, let's start with you.
The fundamental question of all people in all times is that why is the world as it now is? Certainly, if God is good, if the Creator is good, he would not have created the world as it now exists. So something must have happened to result in the world being as it now is. And then if the world is as it now is, and it's not the way the Creator created it, there is an expectation, there's almost a necessity that something happened in order that the world becomes the way the Creator intends it to be. And the means by which that redemption occurs, the means by which the atonement occurs, is that that thing which has destroyed the created order, that thing which has introduced evil and what is not good into the world, needs to be addressed and atoned. And for Lewis, the atonement, Lewis argues that there are a number of ways Christians have described and understood the atonement, a number of ways they've understood the work of Christ on behalf of lost humanity, and that there is no one right way to do so. And I think he's right about that. But at the same time, he says, and he's right about this too, that what is essential to a Christian understanding of the atonement is substitutionary death, the sacrifice of the God-man on behalf of lost humanity and of lost creation. And so that in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it is the sacrifice of Aslan, the innocent, on behalf of the traitor Edmund, which is the reason for his death. And because there is a law of deep magic that if an innocent one sacrifices himself for a guilty party, that one must be resurrected. That explains the resurrection.
Gotcha. Holly, you want to add to that?
Well, I think Glenn said it very well. I think in many respects, you know, when you look at Aslan and what he does, it's clear that at that point, at least, even though I agree with Glenn's earlier comments that I don't think this is allegory in the traditional sense, and Lewis claimed it wasn't allegory. He claimed simply, I was asking the question, if Jesus were to become incarnate in a world where animals talked, animal would he be and how would he appear?
Right.
But I think by this time in the story, the Christian understanding of substitutionary atonement has stepped in and taken over, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so that as Lewis is writing this, he's very clearly understanding, if you don't call it allegory, then what you would say is that Aslan is doing in that world what Jesus did in our world, so that there are clear parallels.
But that story, that part of the story is in every story. That is so deeply embedded, that meta-narrative is so deeply embedded that every story has some means by which the conflict is resolved. And it often includes some form of substitution.
Yes.
But what makes this distinctly Christian is that it's a distinctly Christian telling of the story and using a distinctly Christian and biblical symbolism of the lion. And one cannot watch as a Christian that death of Aslan and not recognize that this is the Lion of the Tribe of Judah dying. I mean, his hair is pulled out, he is shaved, he is mocked, he is beaten. I mean, all the parallels are obvious.
It's an animal passion.
Well,
it's an animal passion without any blood.
That's yeah, right. And beyond that, Susan and Lucy are watching all that from in hiding, and they're asking each other the question, when is he going to pounce on them? Yeah. When is he going to attack his enemies and fight back? Right. And the whole point is, like a lamb led to the slaughter, he allows himself to be killed. He doesn't fight back. Right. He emptied himself.
Yeah, it isn't a lion that becomes. It's a lion that becomes a lamb, not a lamb that's going to become a lion.
Exactly right.
Yeah. That was one of the nice things that. That scene, I think, was very nicely done in that this lion is not tied up. There are ropes around him, but they are loose. There, it's clear from watching the film that this lion is sacrificing himself.
Right.
Well, I think that I think that raises a question about expectations in the movie that's helpful to think about as we wrap up. And that is sometimes when you go to see a movie like this, and you know that there is this Christian connection, your tendency is to want to compare it point by point with what happens in the biblical story. My impression is that you shouldn't walk in and do it that way. That really what's going on here is you're getting the high points, but don't expect all the details Is that a fair way to think about the movie?
I think it is. You go in and enjoy the story. That was one of the values for me watching it twice. The second time I watched it, I not only knew the biblical story, I knew the biblical story the first time, mm-hmm. but I now knew how the film was going to portray the story of the film. And so I could watch it seeing things I hadn't seen before. And because to go in and enjoy the story, it's a great story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think essentially in one of the later Narnia books, and I can't remember at the moment exactly which one it is, the children, when they're back in Narnia later, are told by Aslan, you were sent into this world to learn to know me so that when you go back to your own world, you may know me better there under another name. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really the point of this, that the person who reads the book or who sees the film, you know, starts asking questions and then picks up their Bible and learns to know Aslan by another name.
And I think the movie did this brilliantly in that at the end, after the credits, and some people didn't stay. In fact, in the showing that my wife and I went to, we were the only two people who stayed all the way through the credits.
Me too.
Same here.
And I thought, man, you missed something. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether we should wreck it for the people who haven't seen it yet simply say, stay through the credits.
You should always stay through the credits. Those are people who devoted a great deal of time and effort to doing the work. They deserve to be recognized.
Let's just say it this way. There's a nice little surprise at the end of the credits that's worth staying for. It's like the milk duds at the movie.
Well, to wrap this up, this is one movie in a series. It's going to be interesting to see if other movies follow behind it from the same series. Obviously, there has been great discussion about that, and it's doing well at the box offices, which is probably going to dictate whether an investment is made on future books into other movies. Guys, thanks a lot for your time. Greatly appreciate it. Appreciate your comments, as always, and we'll do this again soon.
For more information about Dallas Theological Seminary, please visit our website at www.dts.edu.